From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, on Thursday, President Obama told House Democrats that his top priority is job creation. But what else will he focus on in his second term? We'll preview the President's State of the Union address and ask you, our listeners, to share what you wish the President would say on issues that are of concern to you, such as national security, unemployment, education, and more. And Forum begins after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. President Obama delivers his State of the Union address tomorrow, and the president has already indicated that he will zero in on jobs and job creation and the economy in general. But it appears likely he will focus as well on such issues as immigration, education, the development of clean energy, the debt and sequestration. In this hour, we preview tomorrow's address, but we also want to find out from you, our listeners, what you feel should be the priorities for the president in tomorrow's address and what the president ought to say about issues that matter to you. And just how important our State of the Union address is. We'll take all that up in this morning's opening Forum Hour. And joining us is Todd Zwillick, who's Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC. He joins us from the nation's capital. Good morning, Todd Zwillick.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Susan Davis back with us on Forum, Chief Congressional Reporter for USA Today, who is also with us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Susan Davis.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Todd Zwillick, let me begin with you by just getting a kind of overview here. I mentioned growth, and a lot of that's going to be in the inaugural address, clearly agenda about economic growth particularly. But the president also said that it's time to end governance by crisis. And I'm wondering just how we might interpret that, particularly in light of the fact that many of these things having to do with the economy and growth were already gone over in his inaugural address.
Well, I think when the president talks about ending government by crisis, which he surely will tomorrow night, it's a poll-tested favorite catchphrase of his, he's really, in an oblique way, taking a stab at congressional Republicans. And I'm sorry to say that the dynamic of governing by crisis is with us to stay for the next foreseeable little while. The president is decrying things like using the debt limit to extract concessions on savings, as Republicans tried to do last year and threatened to do this year before they backed down. He's talking about things like government shutdowns and those types of sort of political brinksmanship that have become the norm on Capitol Hill. They always have been to some extent, but it's really gotten more bold and more common than it used to be. The president will talk about governing by crisis and decry it because he's then going to be able to follow those statements with a couple of crises that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. And the president, I think, hopes that viewers out there outside the Beltway will say, oh, we hate this stuff. This is exactly the kind of thing that the president was talking about in his speech. Government funding, we're facing another potential government shutdown in March. Before that, we're facing drastic spending cuts called the sequester, which is a great deal of money, more than $1 trillion in sort of indiscriminate defense and domestic spending cuts that could go into effect if no deal is reached before between Republicans and Democrats.
Well, the president said he's excited to avert sequester, and he's been talking about tax loopholes as well.
Sure.
This is all political brinksmanship, as you say.
Yeah, it all is, and it is with us to stay because these crises are sort of baked into the process now, and the Congress and the president are still polarized on the key issues. When you take a look at the big picture here on sort of where we are on budgets and some of the brinksmanship we've already had, you know, the economist said, you know, Washington, you have to cut around $4 trillion from the federal debt in order to get us on a sustainable path. You know, debt to GDP ratio is what they talk about. Washington's done a little over half of that. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like they've sort of done nothing and agreed to nothing. In fact, over the last sort of 1.5 to 2 years, they've cut over $2 trillion from the debt. President Obama got $600 billion in tax increases. They've cut spending elsewhere in other deals. They've done it about halfway. Here's the bad news. all of this stuff they've done so far, as ugly as it's been, has been the easy stuff. Nobody's touched Medicare. Nobody's touched Social Security or Medicaid. Defense has been trimmed but not really cut. And those things are where the money is. So as ugly as it's been and as ugly as the brinksmanship has been up to now, that's actually been what we call in Washington, we use the metaphor of low-hanging fruit. So when the president says, I decry the politics of brinksmanship and crisis to crisis, he's sort of positioning himself to criticize Republicans throughout the process that is to come, and that's where we are.
Todd Zwillick, again with us from Washington, is Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC, and Susan Davis is chief congressional reporter for USA Today. And Susan Davis, the clock is ticking on lame duck status. Is there going to be anything new that really can, other than immigration, which to some extent suggests at least some bipartisan crossing of the aisles and all, anything that will be implemented as a result of this speech?
I do think that I don't expect many surprises in what the president's going to say. I think a lot of the agenda, particularly for this year, when it comes to the budget fights that Todd just laid out, as well as the gun and immigration battles, has largely set up the legislative year we're looking at. I think a lot of the State of the Union and the way we will look at it is tone, is atmospherics. A lot of what it sort of sets the tone of the debate going forward. I think that it's interesting that it's the first State of the Union since the president has won re-election. It is the second major speech probably since the inaugural in which, you know, this is now a president who is never going to run for office again. So it'll be interesting to see whether he goes more towards the bipartisan bridge-building tone that he sought in his first term with Republicans, or is he going to take more of a pugnacious, aggressive, I dare you to keep fighting me tone particularly towards congressional Republicans on issues like guns and spending cuts.
You mean, is he going to be President Obama the second debate with Mitt Romney as opposed to the first?
Yes. You know, which president is going to show up tomorrow night? And I do think in the terms of how he addresses the members across the aisle, I think that that is something in particular that Republican leaders are looking forward to. I think it's worth noting that the president has not had a particularly strong relationship, even though it may be personable. It hasn't been very productive with John Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House. And it's probably safe to say he has almost no relationship with the minority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who has been able to conduct business almost exclusively with the Vice President, Joe Biden. So I think a lot of it is going to determine, tone is going to determine a lot of going forward. I would also just say that this is an opportunity for usually about 40 million people tune in to watch this speech. So it does give the president, far beyond the Beltway, an opportunity to try and reach average Americans on the things he's trying to do. And I would expect that I think that there's a lot of expectation, particularly among congressional Democrats, and what they want to hear is they want to hear a jobs agenda. They want to hear a clear, compelling case as to how Barack Obama is going to lift the nation out of what has been largely stagnant 8% unemployment for his first term. And I think they're desperate to have him lay out a vision and give them something that they can rally behind.
Well, he'll have the bully pulpit, as you suggested, with 40 million people in his own party to talk to here about things like job creation and energy and education that concern them. But when I ask about implementation, I'm wondering if we're likely to hear anything about implementation of the health care law and, moreover, next steps for ending the war in Afghanistan by 2014.
Well, I do think that in a lot of ways, State of the Unions, in the beginning, they offer a little bit of looking back, but they tend to be more forward-looking. I would be shocked if he didn't mention his health care law and how they're going to implement it, particularly as states are now starting to set up the systems by which they're going to implement it. I think he will, but he will talk about that in the context of, I think, a success and frame it that way. I also think that there is a possibility to olive branch to Republicans there because the president has shown a willingness to reform the health care law as it's implemented. I saw the president speak last Thursday. He met with congressional Democrats where they were meeting for their annual retreat. And he did say there that he expected to sort of lay out his foreign policy vision about the war on terror and how and where we go from here as we draw down the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he said there that he intended to make it clear that they will continue very aggressive national security efforts and to continue to go go where they need to go to keep the country safe, which is a particularly interesting at this point in time, considering the debate we're having right now with Congress over the administration's drone policy.
Susan Davis, again, with us from Washington, chief correspondent, reporter for USA Today, and also with us from Washington this morning for this hour is George Condon, who is White House correspondent for the National Journal, and we welcome you, George Condon, to the program.
Well, thank you.
Let me ask you about your thoughts on this, because I know from your perspective, just not only historically, but in terms of what expectations might be attached to the president's speech tomorrow, the caveat is don't expect much. We don't usually get a great deal, especially when we think about past State of the Union addresses, and likely perhaps no surprises, particularly in conjunction with Congress and its response.
Well, the only surprise would be if the State of the Union speech turned out to be A, important, and B, helpful to the president politically. We have a tendency in Washington to hype these speeches and to always say it's make or break for the president. And yet if you look at it, out of more than 200 State of the Union addresses, some of them addresses, some of them just written reports to Congress, there are only five that we remember historically. And if you look at the polling, they don't help the president. You have to go back to Bill Clinton to find a president who was really helped by his State of the Union. He was also the one who gave the longest speeches. But most presidents either stay completely flat on approval or go down.
Usually go down. In fact,
right.
President's job rating is pretty good now. I mean, it's rebound from the fall campaign. It's about 59% favorability from, what was it, 50% there. So he's got a lot of risk here in terms of what you're saying.
Right. Well, this is his fourth one, and the first three he was flat. And last year he went into it with a 44% approval rating, and it was so low he did get a two-point bounce, if you want to call that a bounce, up to 46.
But he's laying out his essential, well, not only message to the Congress, but also to the people. And as we said earlier, has the bully pulpit, 40 million expected listeners. This follows the inaugural speech, and it gives him an opportunity to say, this is what I want.
Right. But the problem is, especially when you get into your second term, people are tuning you out. And if you look at the numbers on his speeches, he hit his high point with 70 million on the night that he was elected in 2008, and he's gone steadily down since then. He's lost every time he's down into the 30s. So I actually don't think he'll hit 40 million.
Again, George Conner with us from Washington, his White House correspondent with the National Journal. Taz Willick, let's get your wisdom on this. I mean, the president is clearly going to talk about immigration, about universal background checks and ban on assault weapons, those two sort of central issues that have been brought up as part of the national conversation. And one has to wonder if George Condon is right here, that it's going to maybe fall on a lot of deaf ears.
Well, Susan said something interesting at the top there, which I think is true. Because of the president's agenda, which is clear, and because of events like Newtown, and because of the crisis-to-crisis governance, the budget issues that have to be solved, there's no option there. The agenda for this year largely is set, barring any, you know, unforeseen national security events or things like that. Yes, the president will clearly, I think, lay out the plan he's already released for immigration reform, calling on Republicans, as some have already, to sort of join in bipartisan efforts to solve this intractable problem. He will, of course, position himself to be the winner if we repeat the pattern that conservatives in the Republican Party find themselves unwilling or unable to agree to that critical path to citizenship, if you want to call it that, that you need in order to get a deal done with Democrats. On guns, where there probably is no consensus on an assault weapons ban either, of course the president will talk about that marquee domestic agenda item. He has already said that it's at the very top of his agenda. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, has announced that she'll be inviting a student from Newtown, not from Sandy Hook Elementary, as we understand it, but from Newtown. So there will be optics and camera shots of children and other victims of gun violence in the room. The president has to talk about the stuff that's looming behind all of this, as I mentioned before, not the optional items, immigration reform and gun control, ultimately are optional. Let's face it, Congress doesn't have to do it, but they do have to face these budget issues. They do have to face the sequestration. They do have to face the threat of a government shutdown. They do have to face tax reform, which is an agenda item for later on this year. And while that sounds mundane and wonky, and maybe it is, that tax reform thing that's looming in the future is actually really important, because that is really the only ship leaving the harbor here that could provide the outline of a finally a deal between the White House and congressional Republicans on how to get our debt in order and put all this crisis governance behind us. Tax reform is the thing that could ultimately generate the revenue from closing loopholes or whatever you want to smooth over these fights over spending and sequestration and debt. These are must-do items that loom behind all of, you know, I dare say the sexier political items of immigration and gun control that the president surely will speak about.
Well, if I'm reading you right, what you're saying is that, for example, there's hope and expectation the president will address climate change, which was not even there wasn't even a question asked about it, I don't believe, in the debates, cuts in nuclear weapons and reduction of global stockpiles, voting rights, easier for people to vote. These things become, in the grand scheme, quite secondary or tertiary.
Well, and in every State of the Union speech, there is the risk, and it's really part of the style of these speeches. They can turn into laundry lists of domestic agenda. There will probably be some of that tomorrow night. You mentioned a bunch of important things. Climate change, the Democrats have called a top priority, although very few people imagine that there will be any consensus on that this year. Sure, does the president have to give some lip service to it? Does he have to check the box? Of course he does. Does that mean that it's really at the top of the agenda for this year, when there's a limited amount of legislative time, of political capital, and certainly of political will, and consensus is still very, very short to come by? Check the box, but don't necessarily expect that just because the president mentions it in his speech that it means we're headed for a real concerted legislative effort or any kind of new law.
Susan Davis, is there any significance to the fact that Jon Favreau is no longer the president's speechwriter and Cody Keenan is going to be taking over as chief speechwriter, do you think?
I think it's one of the things that, when I said before, we were talking about tone. I think this is the debut speechwriting effort for Cody. He has been part of the team. I think his previous best-known speech that he worked on was the address that Barack Obama gave after the Gabby Giffords shooting, when he traveled to Tucson and spoke there, which was a very well-received speech. So I think the expectations are high for Cody, probably within the White House. I do think, though, it's telling that he is now chief writing this, and that was his previous speech, because I do think that the gun issue is going to be the issue that is most poignant in the room tomorrow night. At least 20 members of Congress are bringing as their guests victims of gun violence or family members of people who have been victims of gun violence to sort of send a message. My colleague at USA Today, Jackie Kucinich, had a story in today's paper in which they spoke to the historians in the House and Senate, and they could find no real other precedent for members of Congress giving their tickets to such a coordinated collective group of people. The closest they could recall was during the women's suffrage movement, when a group of suffragettes got into the chamber during the State of the Union to protest the president then, but it was unclear whether they had been invited by members of Congress or whether they had broken into the chamber. So I do think that that is going to be something that people are going to hear a lot about tomorrow night. I think there's going to be a lot of focus on those victims. Now, whether that can translate into congressional action on some of those tougher issues like the assault weapons ban, sizing magazine clips, I'm personally skeptical, but it is definitely something that's going to be very felt in the room tomorrow night.
Don't you also think, George Condon, that with the response being handed over to Marco Rubio and being presented bilingual for the first time, that this is maybe a signal from the GOP on bipartisan support for immigration reform?
Well, they certainly hope so. I mean, this is the man that Time magazine has dubbed the savior of the party, and there certainly are a lot of people that hope somebody saves them from themselves. And there have been several speeches, several responses that have been in Spanish. This will be interesting to see one person doing both. But there are very high expectations for his speech, which is unfortunate, because you always look small when you try to respond to the President of the United States, who there's no more ceremonial occasion, an august setting up there in the House chambers, everybody watching, millions, and then you stand there alone against a flag.
It didn't help Bobby Jindal, for example.
Oh, it hurt him. Usually it's neutral. It actually hurt him because he was so wooden.
What about the fact that Rand Paul from the Tea Party is giving a response, too, to the president?
And the whole country is holding its breath. I mean, the expectations are just extraordinary, I'm sure. No, he'll have about as much impact as he did in the presidential campaign.
Well, let me invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. What is most important to you in the president's speech tomorrow? What you would like to hear from the president? And what about these presidential speeches? I mean, it's the State of the Union speech. Many will be listening, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And the real question is, how important are these State of the Union addresses to American citizens, in your judgment? And we're asking you, our listeners, what you feel ought to be the priorities for the president in tomorrow's address and what he ought to say about issues that actually matter to you. And you can feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your calls, whether you're listening on radio, Internet, or Sirius satellite. Join the program at 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free number to join the program now and join the conversation with your questions or comments, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. Other ways to communicate with us, if you prefer, Facebook or Twitter, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and I'm looking at the question that I just put out. What do you hope the Obama administration will achieve in its second term? And here are some of we put this out on our social networks. Here are some of the replies. Keith writes, more peace and less drones, more jobs and less poverty, more transparency and less dishonesty, more vision and less platitudes. And Pete says, exclusive public campaign financing. Juan says, stop killing U.S. citizens, apologize for war crimes, and go to jail and take Bush with him. Unlikely. Kurt writes, fulfill all his broken promises from his first term. And Rob writes on our website, sequester will indiscriminately cut $1 trillion, but that's over 10 years, right? Which is $100 billion a year, a truly modest amount by any measure. Annual spending, annual deficit, Pentagon annual budget, etc. Both Dems and Republicans are promoting governing by crisis to achieve their party's goals, which do not coincide with the needs of the country. Todd Zwillick?
Well, there is an interesting point raised. It's true. The sequester is worth about a little over $1 trillion over 10. Some of the plans that are floating around Congress now want to delay that sequester for 7-8 months, worth about $85 billion. The military is, of course, running around town carping as loudly as they can that these types of cuts will hollow out the force. You hear that kind of rhetoric. The value of the cuts are important, but also the military is upset that the cuts are sort of indiscriminate. They're across the board. They're not really targeted. And that has a lot of people worried. Now, in terms of who's to blame for this, and there's an interesting rhetoric happening on the sequester, and I don't know how much of this sort of filters outside the Beltway, but there's a lot of blame going on for whose idea the sequester was in the first place. Republicans say, well, it was President Obama's idea in the first place. This is Barack Obama's sequester. That's true until you just turn the page on how the sequester came about. The sequester, when we go back to the Budget Control Act and some of the last disagreements over debt limit and the last brinksmanship we had last year, was an idea just to get Congress out of the crisis that it had created for itself in the first place. Speaker John Boehner, who is fond of calling it Barack Obama's sequester, not only supported it, but agreed to this deal. Many Republicans voted for it, and so the White House made sure that they took some ownership of it. And I should add that it was a very important way of kind of saving Speaker Boehner from some of his own conservatives on that deal. They had to get a deal, and the sequester helped get it done.
Todd Zwillick, again with us from Washington, is the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from Public Radio International, WNYC. We will return. We'll hear more from you, our listeners, as we get ready for the speech tomorrow. The address by President Obama, the State of the Union. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Thursday, President Obama told House Democrats that his top priority is job creation, but what else will be the focus of his second term. We're previewing the president's State of the Union address, and we're asking you, our listeners, to share what you wish the president would say on issues such as national security, unemployment, education, and whatever issues are of grave or serious concern to you. And we're also asking the question, how important are these State of the Union addresses? Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, number of other ways to communicate your thoughts with us. You can do it by going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, and you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on this segment, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And with us for the hour is George Condon, White House correspondent with the National Journal, Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC, and Susan Davis, who is chief congressional reporter for USA Today. And Susan, I'm looking at a comment online from a listener who says, easiest way for Obama to create jobs is lower immigration rates.
Well, we're going to see what he says tomorrow night. I mean, obviously, there is an element of that debate in which there's a jobs argument in the immigration reform. And I think that part of how he lays out the case for reform is which argument does he make? Does he make immigration reform as important from a humanitarian, it's the right thing to do element, or do you do it from a this is good for the economy, this is good for jobs? Do you make it part of sort of the meta-economic argument for the reason for an overhaul? Which I think that framing issues in the current climate as job issues or economic boosters probably a more successful way to try and build consensus in the public for them. I think that the economic stagnation that we've had is a far bigger issue, and for those of us inside the Beltway and inside a bubble and inside an industry that has very low unemployment, it's important to remember that outside that the unemployment rates are still one of the, and job creation is still the number one issue for most Americans. It is still, the jobs in the economy is still the number one issue for most American households. And I think part of the reason why immigration is so viscerally divisive is that there is a belief that some of the illegal immigrants that are here are taking jobs away from American citizens. And that is probably not entirely factually accurate because of the jobs that they are taking, but it does have sort of a very emotional, visceral reaction in this debate.
Let me bring our callers in, and we'll begin, Tom, with you as our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning. The speech is very, very important to me and my family. One of your commenters touched upon unemployment. That is a huge issue for us and for nearly everybody we know. And we would very much like the president to focus on the issue of greater security for working families, specifically tying together issues like reforming the tax code. We see in our own lives the huge problems created by a tax code that punishes work, that is a barrier to hiring, and yet that showers favors on people who get their wealth through capital gains as opposed through income, people like Mitt Romney. That's grossly unfair. Why corporations have trillions of dollars overseas sitting idle, they're not hiring. That needs to be changed, and we hope very much that the president is going to highlight that and make that a central focus in his second term.
Well, Tom, I thank you for that contribution. Let me go right to George Condon from the National Journal. Tom's expectations inflated like many Americans in the middle class here, George?
Well, no, I think what he said does reflect what the president believes. The problem is there hasn't been a real coherence or consistency to the president's message. I wish I had a dollar for every time the White House has told us, okay, this is it. The president's going to pivot to jobs today. And we're hearing that again. I mean, I would be a rich man. And I'll give you one other example. Over the weekend, I was talking to a top White House aide, and promised me a preview of the State of the Union and said, now you can't quote me, but the president is going to reaffirm his deep commitment to the middle class. Well, you know, if we still said stop the presses, that would be a stop the press moment. He's going to talk about jobs. He's going to, you know, do this, but I just don't think we're going to see anything that is particularly new. We'll see a repeat of his call for balance in tax policy.
Let me bring more of your calls on. And Lincoln, you're next. Hi, welcome, Lincoln.
Hi there. Thank you for taking the call. Thank you for having such an interesting and important conversation. Now, my question is this, and it's a question to everybody. why, and that question by that statement just a moment ago, that one of the problems is that the president isn't putting out a clear and cohesive message is kind of the center of my question. Why is the White House not offering to the Republicans some sort of grand bargain which says, give us all of the stimulus that we need today, and infrastructure and jobs, and we will guarantee a package of tax reform and budget balancing going forward in the longer term? Why is he not making that balanced offer? Thank you very much for taking the call.
Okay, and thank you for the question. Susan Davis.
It's a great question, and I think the White House would say he did. I think they would say he did a couple times, and I think congressional Republicans would say we did too. And this is when you hear the collapse of things like the grand bargain, or even these impending spending cuts that are coming up on March 1st are a result of congressional failure with the White House to come up with a long-term budget deficit plan. I think you're going to see it again in the next Congress, in which I think part of the reason is there is beyond the regular politics of the day, there is a deep and philosophical difference of what it's going to take to turn the economy around. And I think you've already seen, following what we call the fiscal cliff deal, in which the tax rates on the wealthiest of Americans were allowed to rise at the end of the year, there is zero interest, and I cannot emphasize this enough, there is zero interest among congressional Republicans to raise any new revenues in any deals at any point going forward with the president. And this is where I think we are stuck in sort of the politics of the crisis governing, as the president is likely to talk about tomorrow night. They believe that, is what they will say constantly, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, the president got his revenues, and now the conversation needs to be strictly on the spending cut side. I think at the same time, Democrats are very resistant to any spending cut only package, something that Bill Clinton, as recently as Friday, warned the party to oppose as sort of austerity measures, because growth is stagnant right now, and if we continue to cut spending, we could actually do more damage to the economic recovery. But there is so little consensus and such a bad track record between both and on both sides.
Well, forgive me, Susan, but what you're saying is that congressional Republican leaders in the congressional rank and file in the Republican Party are still pretty much sworn to the oath of Grover Norquist?
Yes and no. I think that they would say that they're not because of the fiscal cliff deal, because the president in the deal that was achieved at the end of last year, beginning of this one, depending how you look at it.
No, but they're saying we did that and now we are not going to allow for anything more in the way of taxes, right?
Yes. And what they are saying in response to it is Dave Camp, and he's the Ways and Means chairman, is going to put forward a tax overhaul. So they want to fundamentally overhaul the federal tax code, but they don't want any more piecemeal deals with the president.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your web comments here. Todd Zwillick, I'm getting concern about drones being expressed here, and I'm not sure if you think the president is going to address that, but also here's a comment from one of our listeners who says, please have President Obama check Attorney General Eric Holder's pulse to make sure he's still alive, and if so, attempt to actually do his job regarding fraud at all levels of the financial industry. You'd be hard-pressed to find a more ineffective attorney general in U.S. history. And so it goes. I mean, here's Jerry who says an important factor in the current debt deficit is the recession. The recession was caused by Wall Street's mismanagement. Wall Street should pay more, not the poor or middle class. I don't think we're going to hear these kind of sentiments, nor for that matter, probably much about drones, are we?
You've probably lumped all three of those concerns very neatly into the category of unlikely to hear a lot of detail.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the tab there. However, on the drone policy, I think you may not hear the, I think you're unlikely to hear the word drone. In fact, that's probably, I'll put a dollar that you won't hear that word in a State of the Union address. But the president, there will be a section of the speech that does deal with national security, and he will have to make some statements about his outlook and his philosophy as commander-in-chief. And here's why. The White House has been walking a very, very fine line politically ever since the release of the Office of Legal Counsel, you know, Justice Department memos on the White House decision tree on the kill list and on the reaffirmation for the American public, even though this was widely reported before, that the president has indeed ordered the killings of at least three American citizens overseas who were alleged by the United States government to be al-Qaeda terrorists. The fine line that the White House has been walking is that this deeply offends the president's liberal base. And as you've seen the responses from White House Press Secretary Jay Carney and other places in the White House about concerns or wanting questions answered about this national security issue, about the kill list, John Brennan being vetted for CIA in front of the Senate last week, you've seen a White House that has had to pay a lot more lip service to the concerns of the general public than a White House ordinarily would on classified issues of national security, saying the president believes these questions are important. The president believes this is an important conversation about drones. Meanwhile, the president has essentially taken President Bush's policy on national security on strikes and gone further than the Republican White House ever did. So they're paying some pretty tortured lip service as far as their liberal base is concerned. Does the president have to touch on his unilateral executive authority as commander-in-chief in the ongoing war on terror, or whatever we're calling it now? He probably does. He will not say the word drone, but there are a lot of liberals, progressives, Obama voters, and his base out there that want to hear him say something, and they want some answers, and I think it's reflected in that response that you just read.
And again, Tons Willick is Washington correspondent with The Takeaway from Public Radio International, WNYC, and our next caller is Robert. Robert, join us. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me speak. I appreciate it. I would really like to see the president address the issue of the existence of the United States Postal Service. I don't have any idea why, but he's avoided it now for almost five years. The problem is a political problem. It's not a financial problem. Postal Affordability and the Accountability Act needs to be addressed. It's and the significance to this is tremendous to the country. We're not talking about, if you're talking about jobs, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs, not only in the Postal Service, but how it branches out and the whole infrastructure of how we move smaller items around this country. Even FedEx and UPS could not exist without the Postal Service. They'd have to pick up part of that because their infrastructure is based upon using the Postal Service.
Robert, I think you won't get disagreement that this is indeed an important issue, and now that we won't have Saturday mail delivery, it becomes even to some extent more highlighted. In fact, we talked about it on Forum on Friday, but unlikely in the State of the Union address, George Condon, I would imagine.
It is very unlikely, and there's an irony here. In that it won't be mentioned because it was taken out of politics. Yeah, there's quotes around that. When Richard Nixon engineered, taking it basically out of the cabinet, out of the government. It used to be that, you had Jim Farley for FDR. You put your campaign manager in as postmaster general, and it was monitored by the president. Now, It's technically independent. It's out of politics. You're not going to hear it in a State of the Union.
Let me thank Robert for the call and go immediately to another caller, and that's Bob. Thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. You're on.
Yeah, thanks very much. I have a daughter who's a small entity inventor who's afraid to go to market because she fears anything that would get in her way, including hiring people and so on. So I'd hope to hear from the president, and I'm blind to politics, by the way, some affirmation for a person going, not next Facebook inventor, but tangible product to be made in America from concept to market, entrepreneuring, something very positive to say, look, we're open for business. Just as Texas is trying to steal from our state of California, I don't want that kind of climate. I want a nation where a child with a great idea can go from concept to market on American soil.
Well, Susan Davis, the president's rhetoric has often been sort of tilted toward free enterprise and entrepreneurship and all of those kinds of things. If he's talking about the need for the middle class to find jobs and move up, that might indeed be part of the text of his speech.
Probably. I almost thought when the last line your caller said where, children should be able to go from enterprise to market with an idea, it almost sounds like a line that the president could deliver tomorrow night in his speech. That sort of, I mean, if there is one thing that Obama is known for, particularly in his State of the Union addresses as he wraps up and in inaugurals, is a particularly aspirational tone. And, I think that the State of the Union as a whole, it tends to be a pretty positive outlook on the state of the country. And I think that those are exactly the kind of ideas that he's going to outline. I will say that where there is a fundamental difference when you talk about things that are actually going to be implemented, so much of what the president wants as part of that agenda, of the innovation agenda, is more money. It's just spending. You can call it stimulus, you can call it investments, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but it's money. And he wants more money, federal money, for education programs, for job training programs, for infrastructure projects like roads and bridges that help create jobs in the country. But it is spending. And this is the continued ongoing issue of his presidency with a divided Congress, is where does the money come from and how do you pay for it?
Again, Susan Davis with us from Washington, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. And in the time remaining, if you have some thoughts about the State of the Union speech and what ought to be in it and what the president ought to address, we welcome your calls. You can join us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Neil, who tweets, "I'm hoping the president will touch base on the budgetary crisis, in particular entitlement and infrastructure reform. I also look forward to hearing his opinion on the legal structure behind drones, especially regarding foreign entities." And we already said that's probably unlikely that you'll even hear the word drone. But let me go to some more emails here. Joe says, "To prevent the State of the Union address from staying a mere political rally and instead become an outline for a serious outline of solutions, the president should request no applause during his speech." And Bill says, "The president needs to lead climate, the biggest issue facing our nation and our planet. He needs to lay out a comprehensive vision of climate solutions. That would include specifics like getting off fossil fuels, creating jobs by building a green economy and climate-resilient infrastructure, and stanching the deficit with higher fees on carbon." What are you expecting on that score, Todd Zwillig?
On climate change, certainly, you know, I think we described this before as a box check in this speech. And I would bet another dollar that the president will mention climate change. He mentioned it pretty prominently in his inaugural speech, which I was a little surprised about. It was a very specific policy area to mention in an inaugural speech, but he did nonetheless. I think you'll hear him talk about it in terms of a detailed, comprehensive plan. I have a hard time imagining the president using this moment to do that, particularly with the schedule. I shouldn't say the schedule, but the agenda for our politics and also the relationship between the White House and congressional Republicans more or less set for the year. We've got limited time here and, again, limited political oxygen for everyone to breathe, and it's all pretty much taken up. He does have to check that box, and he's got a lot of people like your emailer there who want to hear him speak on this issue. It would be sort of curious if he didn't follow up on his strong statement from the inaugural by at least mentioning it, but a direct challenge for Congress to pass something this year, I doubt that he would make such a direct challenge. He would say, "We must do this, and I urge Congress to act and to work with me." That I would think would be a little more likely.
And let's get Peter on. Peter, you're on Forum. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Michael. Thank you again for another interesting program. Listen, I have an observation that there's a win-win that's very rare in political environments. I'd like to hear your guest comment on. There's many large American-based multinationals who, by virtue of revenue transfer to offshore sites and tax havens, have really avoided largely paying their share of the income for the country. I wonder whether the guests could speculate whether a corporate tax cut that also allows for repatriation of some of these revenues that haven't been brought back to the U.S. could actually result in a revenue boost for the U.S. while providing the political narrative of being a tax cut.
Yeah, if, as we've been saying, the president needs more money, which obviously he does and wants more money, George Conan, that would be a way to get more money.
Yeah, I don't know what the actual numbers are, but I can tell you if you look at his past State of the Union addresses, you see a proposal very close to that in there. He has talked about it. Congress has not been receptive.
And Congress, presumably, Susan Davis, will not be receptive.
Probably not, but I would say that the president, the White House has been in prior negotiations, at least open to negotiate on things like the corporate tax rate, and they don't certainly want to go as low as congressional Republicans would like to go, but I do think that in terms of business taxes and and corporate tax rates, there is at least a willingness to dialogue with each other. Whether they can find consensus is an entirely different matter.
Is there still, Susan, as you observe the ongoing conflicts and partisan squabbles and whatnot, divisiveness within the Congress, is there still this divide between Speaker Boehner and, say, his minions and the Tea Party that's as pronounced as it has been?
Yes, I think there is. I think, you know, Tea Party at this point is sort of a very broad, amorphous way of explaining just sort of the division within the Republican Party. I'm not sure it's always as clean as Tea Party and establishment. But yes, he does have a problem. And I think one of the interesting just power dynamics that we are going to see in this Congress, and it was one of the first acts of the year, is when we did see this fiscal cliff deal that was passed. It's important to remember that that deal passed with a majority of Democratic votes in the House, and that the House of Representatives tends by history and by precedent to be a majority-run institution. So there's a question now going forward, is this a new day? If we're going to do things on guns, if we're going to do things on immigration, we're all but certain that that's not going to happen on Republican votes alone. We know it can't happen on Republican votes alone. The question for John Boehner is, how far is he willing to go to let maybe these legislative measures come to the floor on the support of a majority of Democrats and a minority of Republicans? And if that is the case, it would completely reverse the way that the House has done business, certainly since, I would say, probably at least 94, which was the GOP wave, and then in the 20 years since, we've had sort of back-and-forth power control. In the modern way the House is run, it would be a very different tact of how you legislate.
And Susan Davis is the chief congressional reporter for USA Today, and I want to read some comments from a listener named Faye, who says, it is hypocritical for Obama to speak of global warming when he won't do anything about fracking, which is ludicrously exempt from the Clean Water Act. There are more controls on what the corner gas station does with automotive fluids than there are for billions of gallons of chemical cocktails pumped into the ground. While comprehensive climate change depends on the cooperation of other nations, Obama will not clean up what the oil companies do in our own backyard. Lastly, regarding the news media, I hope they won't rush to call Obama's speech, as they did with his inaugural, that he promotes a liberal agenda when he continues so many policies of the Bush White House, including approving even fewer Freedom of Information Act requests than Bush and continuing the budget-draining, life-killing thing called the war. Let me bring another caller on here. Ken, that's you. Hi.
Yeah, I think that one of the problems that he has, and it's never addressed, not even addressed by your panel, the issue is the economy's stupid, and it's really a big issue. And the thing is jobs. And you can't get jobs unless you show up. There's a problem with a solution, i.e., we can't continue the global warming problem. We've seen what's happened across the country. So, therefore, we're getting off fossil fuels. We're going to do it by A, windmills, B, by this, C, by that. And the places that, and these are going to give you jobs tomorrow, because tomorrow you can't go to the gas station to fill up. There won't be any gas. Americans respond to things like that. If you go to the back door with a gun, we'll spend $1 trillion to get rid of one guy with a gun. If you can't get gas in your car or go to work, you respond. Otherwise, things go on, and he doesn't address things this way, and America doesn't see it in context. You can't run a country by putting points on a map and we'll do this, this, and this. We have an integrated problem.
Ken, let me jump in here, because I appreciate the call. I think when I think back on, we're talking about State of the Union addresses, think back on, say, more recent State of the Union addresses when George W. Bush gave his, there was a lot of emphasis on Social Security reform. When President Clinton gave his, there was a lot of emphasis on education reform. If the president indeed puts the emphasis on jobs and job creation, what's going to be the solution? I mean, can anybody at this point venture some prescience as to what the likely solution is? George Conner, begin with you.
Aha, uh-huh. That's the...
that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Our trillion-dollar question, yeah.
I mean, well, he'll continue talking about the things that he has. He sees that it is important bringing the cost of college down, for example, and tuition and student credits. He sees this all linked together. And on jobs, you know, he wants more job credits. He wants Congress to spend more money on infrastructure, which I think Susan mentioned before about austerity. He is not for austerity. He doesn't want just an emphasis on the deficit.
He wants clean energy jobs too. He said
exactly
that many times.
Exactly.
And anything to add on that, Todd Zwillich?
Well, I think you will definitely hear the president repeat his call. Look, he's had a major clash with congressional Republicans over infrastructure spending. This is one of those things in which our politics has changed. It used to be, and you know, I should add that this was back in the age of earmarks when this was a lot easier. Everybody was for infrastructure spending, building roads and bridges. There are roads and bridges in every single congressional district in the United States. Everybody had something to gain by getting the bills through that funded infrastructure spending. Even in economically tough times, there was a consensus that this was a good way to stimulate the economy. People have to build those roads. They have to build those bridges. And by the way, business loves having better infrastructure. The Chamber of Commerce is for it. The manufacturers are for it because goods have to get to market. Trucks have to roll and so do trains. A lot of that consensus is gone because the dirty word is spending, as Sue mentioned before. The president will, I think, when he talks about this sort of crisis to crisis culture that we're in now with our politics, maybe tie that in with the problem over infrastructure spending, but he can't get the spending to do it, and spending has become such a dirty word that he can't get Congress corralled to create the jobs that probably all of them secretly, when they turn out the light at night, would love to get for their districts.
It sounds like gridlock, Susan Davis, doesn't it?
It does. I would say to the caller's question about the economy, a lot of business people you talk to, a lot of outside interests say the best thing government can do is just get out of the way. And in that sense, part of what's holding back the economy is this governing of crisis. The economy likes certainty. So this idea that we're constantly punting on our debt ceilings and whether we could default, or constantly punting over shutdowns or sequester that threatens contracts with companies like Boeing that employ thousands of people, that there's a case to be made that the government itself is hampering economic revival. So it's not necessarily what can government do. It's for a lot of this is what can government stop doing to just let the economy rebound on its own, which it very clearly wants to do when you look at the amount of capital that is sitting within companies. That, you know, the owners say they want to spend it, but they don't know what the tax code's going to be. They don't know what the rules are going to be. They don't know what the regulations are going to be, because so much of it is tied up in this seemingly never-ending gridlock in Washington.
Well, we will continue, obviously, to watch not only the gridlock and how perhaps it might diminish, but also watch and listen to the president's speech, which will be delivered tomorrow from the White House. I want to thank our guest this hour, Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. Thank you, Susan, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, George Condon, White House correspondent for National Journal.
Certainly.
And we thank Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent, for the takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC. Thank you, Todd.
My pleasure.
And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. And let me mention that you can continue this discussion online, talking about the president's speech tomorrow, by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.